So your new book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, it covers various different areas. So can we start by talking about where morality comes from? So there are some philosophers who think, for example, that it's something that's imposed on human nature, but you don't agree with that.
Yeah, some see it as separate, almost separate from human nature. It's like you need to tell people how to behave. And it used to be, of course, God who told us how to behave. And then at some point the philosophers took over and they said reasoning and consensus among us tells us how to behave. And then most recently, Sam Harris, an atheist here in the U.S., said science is going to tell us how to behave. All of these views are top-down views of morality. Like we don't know how to behave, but someone is going to tell us. And I totally disagree with that. I think we have in us, in the primates in general, not just humans, we have in us strong social tendencies that provide social values. And so we value cooperation. We value good social relationships, getting along with everybody. We value a lot of things, and that is built into us. And that's what provides us with the moral values also at the same time. And so I believe much more in a sort of bottom-up view of morality. Is it something that comes from within us and that is provided by evolution?
So in fact, you agree with Darwin, because in The Descent of Man, he wrote, any animal whatever endowed with well-marked social instincts would inevitably acquire a moral sense.
Yeah, you know, in the last 3 decades of the previous century, so between 1970 and 2000 approximately, there were all these ideas, and Dawkins' ideas and the selfish gene very much along the same lines. There were all these ideas that we are inherently selfish and bad, and morality cannot come from human nature, morality must come from the outside. Very un-Darwinian views, almost more like, in my opinion, Freudian views, because Freud, of course, believed that our basic instincts need to be overcome, and that is civilization will help us do that. And thinkers like Dawkins and Pinker, they're basically Freudians, in my view. And Darwin himself believed that morality is continuous with animal nature, that the social instincts, as he called it, of the mammals provided the basis for morality. And my whole thinking is exactly Darwinian in that sense.
You think that morality comes from empathy and altruism, and this is something that you've been working on for a long time, you've written about in quite a lot of your books. But in your new book, you say that you felt like an Australian toilet frog. Could you perhaps explain what you meant by that?
Well, in Australia, they have frogs that cling to your toilet. And so they accept a lot of waste that comes by, and they stay in the toilet. And even if you throw them out, they hop back in. They're very happy there. And I felt like a toilet frog in the sense that for 3 decades, I'd been following that literature that basically says that we are inherently bad and that only with civilization and culture we can be good. And I felt that was such nonsense, such crap, basically, as we say in the US, that I didn't want to deal with it. And fortunately, in the year 2000, everything started to change. And so the neuroscientists, they started to discover empathy. The primatologists like myself, the economists started to tell us that we are more cooperative than you would think. And everything started to change. And now we have a very different view of human nature at the moment.
Because for a while, there were some people who thought that kindness and altruism were somehow maladaptive.
Well, maladaptive. They had only purely selfish explanations for it. And I can understand that as a biologist, because obviously we think that if certain characteristics are there in the human species, they have to provide us with some benefits. But that's at the evolutionary level. That doesn't mean that in your head, but that's how it was confused often. That doesn't mean that in your head you're calculating, how can I take advantage of this individual by being kind or something like that. That's not how things work. But that was the sort of the miscalculation they were making. They were, as we biologists call it, they were confusing the proximate and the ultimate, basically.
I mean, you've said the critical issue now is no longer if animals have empathy, but how it works, so that we're not the only ones that have it. You have clearly demonstrated in your research and in your fieldwork that animals do have empathy. And not just empathy, I mean, even a sense of fairness in canids and chimps and capuchins and now even crows. And this kind of starts with wanting a fair share for yourself and then extends to others through the action of empathy and becomes altruism. Would you agree with that?
Well, empathy is something else. Empathy is that you connect with somebody else. So you connect to the emotions and the situation of somebody else. And it is actually a neutral capacity, because it can also be used, it can also be used for nasty purposes. So you can, someone who's a torturer needs to have some empathy also and understand the situation of somebody else. But most of the time we think empathy is a positive characteristic and is used for positive purposes. And the sense of fairness is something else, because the sense of fairness has to do with resource division. And we've done many experiments with both chimpanzees and capuchin monkeys, and now there are other studies on dogs and crows, basically showing that animals are sensitive to reward division. If you get more than me, I'm going to be unhappy about that. And this is very logical for cooperative animals, because, of course, if I cooperate regularly with you and you take all the benefits, that's not a good partnership for me. So I need to watch that. And so animals are sensitive to that.
What we see from looking at ourselves and other animals is that conflict is inevitable. There's no way we're going to get rid of conflict. It's how we reconcile and console and keep social harmony that matters. And you've done quite a lot of work on that, on consolation and reconciliation.
Yeah, my work actually started with that. My work started with chimpanzees reconciling after fights. And of course, at the time, everyone was so interested in aggression. This was in the 70s. Everyone talked about aggression. And so when I came with the message, yes, the animals have aggression, but they also kiss and embrace after a fight, no one knew exactly what to do with it. But now we have evidence, not just for chimpanzees. We have it for, I think, 25 primate species, and for elephants, and for dolphins, and hyenas, and you name it, all sorts of social animals, also birds, including birds. We have evidence that they reconcile after fights. And if you think of it, it's very important for moral systems, because a moral system is basically one that keeps a society together and sort of sustains cooperation. And so to reconcile with your opponents, the ones you had just a fight with, and to groom them or have sex with them, which is what bonobos would do, or whatever mechanism you use to reestablish the relationship, is just a very important mechanism, and it's part of our moral systems.
Now, I mean, I think part of the problem might have been with the way some people were viewing research on empathy and altruism is that they wanted to think that humans were special. Some scientists, but also people in social sciences and humanities, were just reluctant to let go of the idea that humans must be special in some way. I mean, in religion, you'd say it was the soul, for example, but scientists obviously wouldn't talk about that necessarily, that they wanted to believe that we were in some way very special and different. I mean, the only thing I can think of that we have that possibly other animals don't is the arts. But apart from that, your work's shown quite clearly that it's all on a continuum.
Yeah, I'm a biologist, but I'm a professor in psychology. Psychology is the study of the soul. That's the original term of it, you know. And so in the social sciences, there is this, they're not creationists, because they clearly think that evolution happened. But at the mental level, let's say for the body, they accept evolution, the human body. But at the mental level, they still believe in a sort of very creationist fashion that some miracle must have occurred, and that our brain is totally different. Even though we know that if you look at the details of the human brain has no parts that you don't find in a monkey brain. So the human brain is three times bigger than a chimp brain, which is good, and which I think helps us and increases our intelligence, so to speak. But the human brain doesn't contain any parts or any mechanisms, as far as we know, that is totally different. And so they have trouble in the social scientists to let go of the human uniqueness claim. But there's actually very few claims that you can make. And I agree that humans are smarter and more complex than any other organism in their mental lives. But it is not totally different. It is sort of gradually different.
I mean, you said, for example, that unlike other animals, we strive for a logically coherent system of law and morality. For example, the Geneva Convention, and that's something, obviously, that animals don't do. They don't universalize in the way that we try to.
Yeah, that's an interesting issue. I've been so active fighting for the concept of morality being continuous with animal social life, so to speak, that I have not paid a lot of attention to the differences. And so I've more focused on the similarities and the continuities than the differences. But it is true, if I talk with philosophers, this issue always comes up. It is true that humans like to objectify these rules. And so it's not just a rule that applies to you and to me, we know each other, but it also applies to strangers that we barely know. And we apply these rules and we try to make them general. We try to provide them with some logic. So we say, if you accept the death penalty, shouldn't you accept abortion? That kind of discussions we have about logic. And that's, of course, not the sort of discussions that chimpanzees have. And so there are differences. And maybe it's time that I start exploring the differences now they have worked so hard on the similarities.
There's a sort of another area that you talk about in the book, which is religion and atheism. And you've talked about how the enemy of science isn't religion, it's dogmatism in general. For example, you've challenged the views of Huxley and more recent people like Hitchens and Dawkins. You've written, "While I do consider religious leaders and their representatives fair game for criticism, what good could come from insulting individuals who find value in religion?" And do you find that you have a more humane view based maybe on your experience of other animals and your understanding of psychology?
Well, I know a lot of religious people. My parents were religious, and I cannot hate people like that. And if they find solace in religion and this is what provides them guidance in their life, the most important thing in our human lives is why are we here? What is a good life? How should I lead a good life? Those are important questions, and some people answer them with religion, and some people, like myself, I'm not religious, we try to answer them without religion. But I'm not going to hate an entire category of people, which is a very big category in this world, just on the basis of religion. And so I'm arguing in the book that dogmatism, where you take such a strong stance against something else, is actually more dangerous than just trying to live with others. And I'm more like a humanist. Humanism was never anti-religious. Humanism was always lived in conjunction with religion. And humanism is not religious, but it's not anti-religious. And that's basically how I am.
So moving away from the book a little bit, can you tell us what you're working on now and what sort of new developments we might be expecting to see in the near future?
Well, we recently did an experiment where we played the ultimatum game with chimpanzees. That was an important study because the ultimatum game is the ultimate test of humans of fairness. So the ultimatum game is, let's say I give you $20. You have to split them with your friend, but your friend has to accept the split. And so if you give your friend, let's say, $1 and you keep 19, your friend may not accept that offer. And then you both lose your money. And so if you play that game with humans, you get very much equitable splits, 50-50 or 60-40. And we played it with chimpanzees, and the chimpanzees did exactly the same.
I've often wondered with humans if it would be different if they were using their own money rather than money the experimenters had given them.
Yeah, that's a good one. I don't think people do that. Because, of course, it's very hard to set up an experiment with your own money, but usually we give it to them.
Maybe I'm not very nice, but I think I'd be much more generous with money that wasn't mine.
Yeah, but still, humans don't always accept these offers, and that's why we think actually the equitable split that humans make is partly to prevent problems with the partner. And that's exactly what we think for the chimpanzees as well. And so you can call it a sense of fairness, or you can say it's maybe in order to prevent trouble. But those are the mechanisms that we see. We played the same game that we had for the chimpanzees. We played exactly the same one with children between 3 and 5 years old, and they did exactly the same as the chimpanzees.
I guess it's because you want to avoid the repercussions of being seen as stingy, isn't it, in a social context, especially in smaller groups where everyone knows everyone and people talk about each other, and you know, you don't want to be labelled as the person who's stingy or unfair.
Yeah, that relates to the issue of what we call reputation. What is your reputation in your group? And actually, one of the reasons why we think religion exists, because there's a lot of people who are thinking about the evolution of religion. One of the reasons is that we have created now societies that are so big that this kind of monitoring, where you keep an eye on everybody and build reputations and so on, it has fallen apart. It falls apart in large-scale societies. And so if you live in a small society of 50 to 100 people, yes, you don't need God and you don't need religion to keep cooperation going in that society. But if you have a society of 1 million people, you cannot rely on these mechanisms of reputation. And that's why we actually think that religion came into play with gods who are monitoring everything you do. Because now, instead of us monitoring you, we have this almighty in the sky who keeps an eye on you. And so there are actually good theories about the origin of religion out there.
Yes, you need some kind of supernatural enforcer, don't you, with punishments and rewards set up.
Everything, yeah. Everything in place that normally we would do in a small-scale society, now God is going to do for us.
So what else are you working on at the moment?
We work on cooperation. We work on gambling. So sort of risk-taking by primates. We work on bonobos and on empathy in bonobos. Like we study, for example, how bonobos console distressed individuals. Let's see. I have a colleague, Josh Plotnik, who works on elephants, cooperation in elephants. And so we do all sorts of experiments, yeah.
Do you think things would be very different if we discovered bonobos before chimps?
Yeah, I sometimes wonder that, because we are so focused on chimps. And with we, I mean the anthropologists. The anthropologists have decided that the best model of human evolution is going to be the chimpanzee, because chimpanzees have warfare, and they have dominance, and they have politics. I wrote this book, Chimpanzee Politics, long ago, about coalitions and how they try to become dominant over each other. And all of this thinking fits very nicely with how the anthropologists think about the human past. And the bonobo, since it's more matriarchal, more sexy, more peaceful, females are in charge. The anthropologists don't know what to do with the bonobo. But the bonobo is exactly equally close to us as the chimpanzee. Genetically, there's just a genome has come out, I think, 3 months ago. Genetically, the bonobo is exactly as close to us as the chimpanzee. And so there's no reason to favor the chimpanzee in this story of human evolution. But that's what people are doing.
I mean, I don't know what it's like on American TV, but over here, certainly, you don't get bonobos on TV very much. You certainly couldn't put them on at family viewing time. You see far more chimps on TV than you do bonobos.
Yeah, that's a history. Since I've worked on bonobos so long, when Frans Lanting, the photographer, and I did our book on bonobos, we had trouble getting the message out because we had very explicit pictures of bonobos doing very explicit things. And so we first went to a German magazine, Geo magazine, which is like National Geographic in Germany. And they put copulating bonobos on the cover. And so with that magazine, we went to a publisher in San Francisco and said, well, this is what the Germans do. Would you want to do that? And they decided to do that kind of stuff. And so finally we got the book out. And Americans were much less shocked than people thought they would be. So I think maybe that needs to happen in England also at some point.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, man, I've read your book. We have it here. But I think we are possibly a bit sniggery when it comes to sex here.
Uh-huh.
And a little bit prudish as well sometimes. So that might have influenced it. Finally, to wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to tell our audience about your book other than to buy it?
To buy it is a good thing. And in the book, since I also review humanism, I use Hieronymus Bosch, the painter. So there's quite a few sections, since I'm from the city where he came from. And he was, in my opinion, a humanist painter, because he depicted, of course, heaven and hell, but he also depicted human life. And so he's an interesting painter in that he clearly had trouble, a little bit of trouble with religion, and that's reflected in his paintings. And he had a view of human morality that is quite independent of religion, like many people nowadays have, like myself. He was sort of struggling with, do we need God and do we need religion to be moral beings? And so I use Bosch a little bit and have illustrations of him in the book to explain that sort of very ancient type of Dutch humanism.
Okay, if there's nothing else you'd like to add, I think that's probably time to wrap up now. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
We'll put links so that people can find out more on the Pod Delusion website. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.